I like this.
Okay, call this meeting to order if members should take their seats.
They're not on the street, buddy.
Representative Abler, just so the members know here, we have two bills on the schedule that because of paperwork difficulties did not end up in our possession. But because we've got them scheduled, we're going to hear all the testimony for them, and we'll take action next week. So let's real quick, Representative Gazelka, have you read the minutes? The minutes of the March 22nd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Abler, no motion needed, but if you would please walk us through House Bill 2832.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking to the non-motion, I have an unofficial engrossment, so it's not even a real bill. So it's a draft of an unofficial engrossment. How does that sound, Mr.
You can
Chair?
Speak unofficially if you're on a bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll just go through the bill, and I think that some of this might require some digesting over the weekend anyway, so people can think about it. In brief, Article 1 reinstates the now mothballed MEEP program, which stands for Minnesota Employers Insurance Program. And the goal of that is to try to find a way to help people who have no other pool to go into to be allowed to pool into here. It is in kind of a de facto workable NIWA. The goal of which is to help create what's called a natural population of 30 to 50,000 or more lives of people who are randomly just in, not skewed sick especially, to allow especially small and medium-sized employers to have somewhere to go. I'm sure you've talked in the past about MIWAs and the AMOM proposal and ways for small employers to pool. Certainly, it's difficult. Especially, and the biggest problem with that, if you can get into a plan, the problem is the risk of future price spikes. This bill, this part of the bill, if it were enacted, would not guarantee low rates, it would guarantee trend. Which, if you've heard testimony from some of your small, medium employers, the ones who are out of the rate band, that would be a great relief to them not to risk 20 and 40% increases. That's the goal of this bill, of that, Mr. Chair. And all the details of that are simply ways to reform what was there to make it more functional in the opinion of this author. The makeup of the organization who runs it would be people who are interested in seeing it go forward. There's details that may be beyond this presentation about coverage, special providers, enrollment options, how they'll rate them, the taxes, and so on. I think the question that is before this body is there a will to create a vehicle to allow medium and, they're officially large employers if you're above 51, but to allow these employers that are unable to go somewhere else or that want to have a chance to pull together to do that. In terms of the enacting of this, if this were to be passed and the appropriation allocated, the start button on this would not start until the governor appointed the board. And so this could be something that would lay in wait until there was a large enough pool coming out of the redone PEEP program, which might choose to spin off into this. So that's the discussion about that, Mr. Chair. There's some other provisions which are controversial to some, and even to me. In Article 2, which is page 8, there's two features there which I think are not my first choice, but I think necessary and reasonable. In the case of the Section 1, Article 2, it suggests allowing the deductibles to be increased to $5,000 per person and $10,000 per family, which mirrors MCHA. It's only allowable, not required, but in the cases where some people have no coverage whatsoever, giving them a chance to get some coverage, I think, is a good idea. It just gives plans flexibility. I want to point out one thing to members, too, conceptually. In the you may have heard the Department of Health report about coverage. But just to summarize it in about 30 seconds, between 2001 and 2004, people in group coverages reduced 8% in those 3 years. People in estate plans, Medicare, medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and those increased 18% in that same period of time, while the uninsured increased 30%. Those are different. Those percents aren't equal numbers of people. But the point I see is that we need to find a way to shore up the group coverages and help people get into them, and because we cannot afford to backfill them in the state programs and we don't want them to go uninsured. So all the intent you'll see in my work is to try to push people, woo them in, get employers to come back, and to keep offering decent plans. In the same way, the lifetime maximum benefit in Section 3 would move to $3 million, which would go from, this would be for HMOs only, it would move them from first place to first place. Currently there's no limit. MSHA has a $2.8 million limit. You all sitting here who have state plans have a $1 million lifetime limit, and the self-insured have no standard on what they can do. Anecdotally, there's rumor that some of those are now $300,000 and declining in an effort to preserve some costs. I'm told this limit, which I don't like, but I think we should do, because this is not usually the bill I bring forward, Mr. Chair, it's worth a quarter to half a point, I'm told, which is substantial, maybe the marginal difference. Section 4 is an effort to increase some more information that's already provided about the plans to people who want to search for a plan. There's much more business interest in it, but most businesses are busy doing business, and so they would like to have one-stop shop they could go to. And this would allow the Commerce Commissioner, if they chose to provide this already submitted information online. The Section 5 on page 9 is medication therapy management care. It's a great concern of mine. I believe this saves both money and will increase access. There's some controversy, though, just to give you a heads up about that. Not in the fact that it's a good idea, but that it is a mandate. But I think members need to consider, even in that context, that to provide quality pharmaceutical management on people who are getting more of their prescription by mail, and they'll never see a pharmacist in many cases. They'll see the doc who will then make a prescription, a new doctor that they got from the new plan they're in, there's another prescription. It's only for people with four more medications and two or more chronic conditions, so it's a limited group, but these are the high-cost folks, many of whom are managed anyway. Section 6 is the medical malpractice report. The point of that is to take current information and provide data on what the malpractice situation is and the rates and so on. So when you debate it again next year, you'll at least be able to discuss all the same fact base and not rely on innuendo or looming problems, or that it'll be a fact-based discussion. The service cooperative article, Mr. Chair, members on page 11, has to do with, maybe you've heard of the bill or not, this is the Socorro bill, if you know about that one, allowing service co-ops to get in the reinsurance business. And my idea of that is, I had a bill before, which would have come to you if it survived me, but I killed it myself, about allowing a statewide reinsurance pool option, which has some merit, but the only need area is not in the robust vital market of 3M and other places, but the new groups that want to start up, like a new MIWA, like a new MEEP. It's hard because there's no experience to get those folks reinsurance so the creative idea they want to have can come. Or a co-op may have trouble with a new pool they want to establish to find the reinsurance for them. And that's the idea that I think has merit in this, allowing the co-ops to do something, at least move that ball forward. And I think that's the bill. Mr. Chair, there would be amendments that I'd be offering. In one case, one amendment, which I don't think you have in front of you, would be to allow, given the lifetime limit, that those folks should get to be allowed an MTRA right off the bat. If you spent $3 million in your lifetime, I would gamble no one's going to give you insurance. What do you think, members? And so I think they need to be waived to go into MTRA right away. And that would be an amendment that would allow that. In the medical malpractice report, there's some technical changes from the Department of Commerce that they would keep that fiscally neutral and possible. And the third amendment I would be offering would be something from where the Commerce Department and the co-ops are working on requiring co-ops to be licensed to sell reinsurance, which creates quite a high bar. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Questions from members? Representative Yarrow.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you're the chairman of the health cost containment.
Healthcare cost containment committee.
Okay. This is your bill for the session and from your committee.
Mr. Representative Yarrow, this is the commerce portion.
Oh, okay.
There's some health stuff. There's some state government items. You're only seeing the commerce portion.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I meant to speak with you. I introduced a bill that's the so-called healthcare cost study commission back about 15 years ago, and Senator Samuelson from Boehner, he was chairing the higher ed, I mean, healthcare finance in the Senate. He was kind of reluctant because we were about to pass health maintenance organization bill, which was supposed to be a panacea for healthcare costs, and I think it just added another bureaucracy.
Yeah, how'd it work? Pretty good.
Yeah, but we had a few hearings that said that there are three basic reasons why healthcare costs is going high. So in the 80s it was 10%, and now it's probably 20-30 per year. Lack of policy, state and the national. Well, there are policies, but of course they're creating more and more bureaucracy. Administrative costs, at then we thought it was from 10-20%. I read an article recently that said the average is about 32% administrative costs. And then technology, of course. We found out that there were more MRIs in the Twin Cities than entire Canada. The way to stop the healthcare costs rising is to control the administration. We could cut that out by about two-thirds, almost two-thirds, if we had one system, simple system, the so-called single payer. Well, anyway, and technology. Technology is nice. It's really good, but who can afford it? It's really raising those costs. Those multi-million machines, dollar machines, and operating rooms have to be paid off. In Duluth, I think we have three or four of them. We could probably get by with one, but, you know, it's a moneymaker, probably. Anyway, so do you think we'll ever socialize the system to finally... and socialism is not a bad word. It means people. Peopleize it. Let's have it to serve the people. To make it simple. I used to sell health insurance, long-term care, catastrophic care through a fraternal organization. And I quit. I collected 60% commission on each premium I sold. First year, that adds to the overhead. But anyway, you think we will? I'm sorry. I commend you for this bill, but I hope you can overhaul it totally and solve this problem. It should start in Minnesota like it did in Saskatchewan. We can't wait for Washington. They're just too incompetent or slow or something in both. I don't know.
Representative Abler.
I agree that Minnesota should be a leader, Mr. Chair and members. I think the other bill is a different bill. So that'll be a little more controversial than what I'm bringing forward today. So
I hope you will carry it.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to applaud Representative Abler and his committee for a lot of tough questions they're asking about healthcare delivery in Minnesota. I have three questions for you, and you may have answered them, but you could indulge me again. You gave some numbers about the growing number of uninsured that we have in Minnesota. I think we all share that concern. My first question would be, how many, if we were to pass this, how many more do you think we might get into the insurance, overall insurance pool, which I think we could all agree is a good idea. The second question I have is some of you would be proposing possible increases in deductibles for people in HMOs, and do you think that that would have a counter effect and actually maybe driving some people out? And then the third question I have, I don't know if you mind me asking all three at once. The third question I have is, you commented on service cooperatives, and in northwestern Minnesota, the Northwest Minnesota Service Cooperative has been very effective at pooling insurance for public employees and contracting that out with Blue Cross. And recently, Beltrami County actually bought in and was able to reduce their premiums by over 10% by joining that. And if you could outline a little more specifically how you intend to encourage service cooperatives. And I think you mentioned something about that.
Representative Abler.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Actually, in terms of how this will lower the uninsurance, if actually we stop today, we have to stop the erosion of the group market. That's what I'm convinced about. That is, right now there's 68.2%, or at least in 2004, 62% in the group market. In 2001, there was 68%. So they lost 8% in that time. If we held that at 62% or whatever the current number is, the number of insured, at least that would stop the tide. And so how do we keep employers continuing to offer as well as bring new employers in. That's a dual part. So stopping the skid is a start, and then to draw them back in through things they would offer. And the goal of which is to have nobody be uninsured, at least as few. I think there's probably a hard number of 3 or 4%. You never get beneath that number because people just who don't want to pay the money or just for some reason choose not to, even if it's available for low cost. But right now, I think we're about 7.2% or something. The deductible question, it's only an option. And so if an employer is going to offer nothing or an option, or if a person wants to buy an individual plan and have an option, they could maybe afford to have something so at least they wouldn't lose their house. We've heard about rural families who actually pay their bills, but they have no insurance and they break their leg and they literally lose their house. And a $5,000 deductible plan or $10,000 per family plan becomes very affordable as a way to keep your house intact. Just one point about the $5,000, $10,000 plans. I'm told by the plans when they get to that level, when they pay the $5,000, it's 100% after that. So that's their max amount of pocket. And the final thing about service co-ops is, the service co-ops to me don't provide a panacea, but where I've seen them do their work, when they're doing really well, they're like tiki boats. Just they're effective, they're targeted, they're really responsive to their small groups. Some of the prices can go up because their groups are so small. But in terms of the service level and their innovation, it's incredible. And so I'm trying to encourage some of that, and maybe that will work its way into the system just by competition and mimicry of good ideas.
Okay, I've got Representative Pepin and Loeffler, and I think there's some people in the studio audience who would like to testify. Oh, and Vandiver, sorry. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I actually just had a comment from Representative Yaros before. I just wanted to point out there actually was a bill that was a universal health care bill that was heard in the Health Committee, but it was Representative Walker's bill, but she'd pulled the bill.
Mr. Mm-hmm. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. I know you've worked hard on a lot of different fronts trying to address this whole health care cost containment issue, but I heard as you were summarizing what's before us, which I'm not sure if it's an official committee action or if it's just for information, that it seemed like there are quite a few things that yet needed working out, that had implications that even you weren't quite comfortable with, and I just wanted to clarify, is the intention that this will soon be before us for final action, or is this, I'm just kind of confused.
Yeah, the chair could answer that.
Representative Abler, if you'd like to,
Representative, this would have been an action day if the bill would have arrived. The engrossing was more complex than anticipated, and so the bill was not motioned off the floor. So it was lost, apparently. It was in wherever bill limbo is, it was there. And now it's on its way to here. So there's no action possible. Today is information, and then we can discuss it, but people can email me here. So there will be action by Tuesday night, I would guess, on these features. And the amendments I mentioned will be finalized and brought forward for you at that time.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for clarifying that. One area that I really do have some concerns about is while we're all working really hard to make health insurance more affordable for individuals and for small businesses and to, you know, make it possible for people to join groups, which I agree with, we're making, I think, it less affordable for people who have serious or chronic health issues and would really like some background from the people who've been working on this with you about, as we consider this seriously, but what the real projected impact is when we increase for singles potentially an additional $2,500 of out-of-pocket costs between the increase in the deductible and the increase in the maximum out-of-pocket, and this all when they're covered by an HMO policy. And it would, for families, as proposed, increase the maximum on a deductible up to $4,000 a year, by $4,000 from $6,000 to $10,000 a year, and an additional $2,500 of out-of-pocket costs. So for a family, it could be $6,500 more than the current base right now of $10,500 if I'm. And so I think for many families, the concept of even swallowing that first $10,500 when they have a seriously ill child or they themselves encounter serious illness is a major hurdle. And then to increase it by these kind of numbers, I'm not sure if we're making it more possible for maybe employers to offer something, but then we're going to have families dropping it because they feel like it isn't going to offer anything to them in their normal year-to-year sort of experience. Because when people buy insurance and decide to sign up as employees, they're evaluating, well, what's the risk of I or my child getting sick? And if you feel like the first, you know, $10,000 is out of your own pocket, I think it'll be a harder sell to get people as employees to enroll. And so I just really would, not having heard the discussion, I'm sure you had a lot of this in your committee, if there's some background materials you had or something, I'd be interested in what the trade-offs are, because I really think those are very big numbers to absorb before you actually get an insurance benefit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ablis.
Well, let me point out at the beginning here that the towers that the big insurance companies do business in, are the money for that comes out of the margin. Just, you know, that isn't just money that they got a grant from the government. They earn that money in the market. And actually, some of these high deductible plans actually put that money back to the people who might not pay as high a premium. The premiums on a $10,000 or $5,000 deductible policy are really low. If you put the money and bank it, as I used to when I had my own insurance, I paid for a whole deductible and a half on my high deductible plan, just so you know. But the choice is this. If you have no coverage at all, or this plan that's not a very good plan, that's a choice that you have to consider that you're allowing for people. If the employer drops coverage because rates have gone too high on the fully insured plan that they had, and now people are going to the individual market, and they have a pre-existing condition, they're an MCHA. With the same deal. This is an MCHA level, and you can buy different options at MCHA. You can buy, I think, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, or something like that at MCHA. And that's a challenge that I see. The self-insured, this is only about the 22% of the market that's an HMO fully insured product. The self-insured, they can make it any deductible they want. They can have lifetime maximums of, there's an anecdote that one has 25,000 lifetime maximum. That's the burden. I mean, do I like this? Do I like, but I think reality says we've got to find a way to keep people in quality health care. Minnesota Care is an alternative for any of these plans, is a poor alternative. The reimbursement rates in Minnesota Care are below cost for most clinics. Ask your physicians in your clinics and hospitals at home. Do they want to have Minnesota Care patients come in? They will serve them. But they have to have other business to cross-subsidize the losses they take. And the hospital benefits in Minnesota Care are only $10,000. So is it a good choice? I think it's not a bad idea. And I think to be prudent, and it's a hard, hard area to do, walk through the minefield, but I think it's prudent. Even as I have my reservations that I share with you.
Okay, Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I have a bill that would contain health care costs by adding more choice and competition, but right now it's bottled up in the Health Subcommittee on Thinking Inside the Box. And I'm wondering if it would be possible to move that maybe to yours today on the floor. Representative Bradley's here. Maybe a nod would...
Representative Abler.
You have to take it up to the chair. The nod didn't show up on the tape. I couldn't tell which way he was nodding, Mr. Chair.
There was just a smile.
Representative Andrew.
I guess I'm getting, it looks like a stone wall, Mr. Chair.
No, there was a smile.
I represent Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Vandiver, there was a smile, not a stone wall. Representative Abler, I guess since this is the bill coming out of your committee, you talked about my huge concern, which is the, and I don't see, I'm sorry, I was a few minutes late. Is there something in here that at all deals with the enormous problem of the cost shifting onto people who either have individual policies or even worse, onto people who don't have policies at all? The worst number one culprit is the government. Number two is HMOs probably, but I think it's just an outrageous situation we have here, and we're contributing to it. Have you got anything in this, since your committee is kind of dealing with these costs, is there anything in this proposals that deal with that, shifting it back to so that it's fair to everybody?
Representative Abler?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually the budgets that have been passed for the last 15 years or so in a bipartisan way have pushed the big cost shift onto the private market. I mean,
you blame any party.
Yes, it's been a joint effort, and the monies that are involved are very large in terms of the state plans and even the federal plans, which are a little more generous. But it's a lot of money to fix it. There's been efforts to let the uninsured have discount prices, both with some efforts by the Attorney General as well as the bill that we passed last year allowing the providers to accept discounted payments. That's about the best you can do. I see a witness has appeared at the table that maybe we should testify, Mr. Chair.
Mystery witness, please identify yourself.
I wonder what that is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fran Bradley, Chair of the Health Policy and Finance Committee. I did have a bill one time that said, let's stop being so enamored by expanding eligibility until we fix the price level that we pay. And it didn't make it. I really worry at times that we've had so many proposals to expand eligibility, but we've been unwilling to, and I can't get support across the other body for dealing with the fact that we're reimbursing below cost. So I think the issue is eligibilities, expansions, more benefits versus paying what you need to pay so you can have providers support the public assistance programs.
Representative Mueller?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I agree with the expert on the fact that they're all tied in necessarily together, but I understand your viewpoint on that.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm a lot of questions, but one of the points that you made about Minnesota Care not working is the low reimbursement rates. What about raising those reimbursement rates? Did your committee look at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, actually my committee spent most of the time in the private group sector. The public sector discussion is a very expensive one to take on. We didn't get a fiscal note, but one could be gotten for what it would cost to raise MinnesotaCare and medical assistant rates to even the average HMO price. I have to think it's about $500 million or something like that. It's a lot of money. And some people say, well, the HMOs are keeping their profits. Well, in most of the other programs, in many cases, the HMOs lose money on their government programs. But I want to point out to members that there's nothing wrong with having the state programs. I think we need to have those. We need to reach out to those groups and keep them as whole as they can be and keep them out of the emergency room where it's even worse. But my suggestion here is, given the challenges in that world, the less you put pressure on that and save those dollars that are really needed for the people that need that as a permanent choice, which there's some people that wind up there with that, that if we can keep people moving into the public sector, or into the group employer kinds of coverages and grouping together, and people who have small employers grouping together, you'll take a lot of pressure off, and there'll be actually more dollars available in the state budget to serve in a better way the people who remain in the state programs. That's my, and I think it serves both groups well. There's just not enough money, and people will pay in taxes to handle an eroding group market and to pay the right prices for those public programs.
Mr. Chairman, to Representative...
Representative Paul is to that point.
To Representative Clark's point.
Oh, okay, then I can come back.
We did have a bill in front of our committee this year where there was a proposal to move private employers into Minnesota Care. The department was asked just how much would this benefit set cost on if it was underwritten by the department, and the answer was about $800 to $1,100 a month, and that includes hardly any hospital coverage to speak of. So really, even at $1,100 a month, as much as $1,100 a month, you still would not have the type of health insurance people would expect, because $10,000 cap on Minnesota Care doesn't go very far at all.
Representative Clark, thank you.
I mean, all of this costs a lot of money, and I guess we have to figure out if we want a real health insurance system in this country or the state or not. And one of the questions I guess I'm wondering if you looked at, Representative Abler, is the, you know, I'm not sure what the department was, what they were all considering when they were looking at those figures, 1,100 a month. But did you look at the comparative administrative costs of, say, Minnesota Care and medical assistance to
the private system you're suggesting here, did you ever put those numbers on a piece of paper and look at them and get them and compare them? Administrative costs.
Yeah. Well, they're all, most of the, in fact, I think all of the Minnesota care now is in, it's all managed. It's all on PMAPs. And so those are the HMOs that generally run those. Chair Bradley can discuss more about it, but the range of administrative costs generally for those, even counting, it's a little less for the public ones because they don't pay MCHA on those, but when you pay MCHA, it's like in the range of 8 to 9 to 10%. It's under 10%. Generally, I suppose the state finds it less because there's no MCHA.
And, what do you think what do you project the administrative cost would be for this sort of proposal?
I expect it to be comparable. I think there's a place you can't go below where it costs a certain amount of money to run it. And so it would be competitive. I would, and just to actually, if we get back to the bill, that'd be fine. I know that Chair has other things on the...
I am addressing the bill, and I'll
address that part of the bill, because my imagination on the NEAT resurrection is to create a board who's enlightened about how to run, who wants to do this, who wants it to go forward. And that they would contact with a third party administrator or with some plans to set up a number of options under there, much like what the CGIP does. You get to pick one of your plans, and in PEEP they're going to offer an HSA, they're going to offer a normal one, and so you could pick from an array of options that meet criteria based upon all their efforts to cost contain, and then the employer could choose how much they want to pay and then offer it to their employees, and then they would get reinsurance from somebody. Or a part of their plans, and so it would be like a 50,000 gas station owners and lives coming together, along with whoever else wants to take a crack at this idea. That's the design of it. So it would approach trend. At least it keeps them away from the spikes. The problem in smallest of groups is if one person gets sick, then the group is toast. And so if they had a bigger group that they could pull across, then they hit at least their annual increases.
Okay, we need to go take testimony from the public now. And just so members know, we're trying to line up a room for after session. I think we've got too much here that we're not going to be able to get through. Unfortunately, we're going to end up in one of the little sweat boxes, like north or south things. And my apologies for not getting one of those ahead of some of the little smaller committees that beat us to the punch. Yeah, you can blame it all on me. So we don't have a good list of testifiers right now. We do have a few people on the list. Lynn Gruber, Aaron Sexton, John Schwartz. If you would please, Lynn Gruber, please come forward. I'd just ask everybody to keep their testimony brief. No, I'm sorry, I was supposed to scratch you off that. My apologies. Aaron Sexton from the Chamber. Nope, doesn't have to. Anyone else? might be picking up. Mr. Gross, welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy from the Department of Commerce, and I want to compliment Representative Abel and all the long hours he's put into this bill. A couple of things I just want to briefly comment about Article 1, NEAT. NEAT was created a number of years ago, and basically, one of its big problems was over time it just was not competitive with the private market. So let's hope that we address that this time and make sure that it's going to offer coverage to people that obviously need it, but also make sure that it becomes competitive. Also, as Representative Abler has already commented about, Commerce Department had some concerns about the medical malpractice report. There's some items there that we just cannot get from the industry, and the times are not appropriate, so we're going to be working with him to get that modified. And as for the service cooperatives, we've been working with that organization too, because that organization wants now to assume reinsurance or more or less stop-loss coverage. It's a very risky thing to get into, so we want to make sure that whatever they do, they're properly regulated, they're licensed, they're solvent, and they can easily assume the risk, and then also provide to us a periodic report to make sure that everything's going fine. But we're working with Representative Abler and other legislators to make sure all those work. Thank you.
Mr. Gross, I have a question just on the MEEP. Is there any concerns how would this be capitalized? And I shared this concern already with Representative Abler, and how do we make sure that we've got the capitalization necessary to protect policyholders?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not really sure about that, how that's going to be done. I know they can get a $1 million loan from the Health Care Access Fund to get started, but that part is, I don't know.
Representative Abler?
The loan from the Health Care Access Fund is only a loan, and it's meant just for startup costs. And if $1 million is a placeholder, it might cost about that much, copiers and the staff and so on to start up an actuary or whatever they need. The capitalization is done by allowing the board to charge up to 3 times the first month's premium. The target goal for the capital is 20 to 29%, and 3 months gives about 25%. And so within that range, the board could choose to draw some people into the little lower one and have some people pay the full 3 times. And it's spelled out that that's actually prepaid premium, and so at the end of the time that they go, if there's sufficient reserves, that's refunded to the people who'd be leaving at the end of their 3-year time. It's a 3-year term that they have to stay, so it's stable.
Okay.
Is that how?
So, okay. Any questions for Mr. Gross? Representative Goodwin?
Oh, not for Mr. Gross, on the bill.
Okay, well, let's see if we can go through further testimony then. Thank you, Mr. Gross.
Thank you, members.
Did John Schwartz want to testify? Nope. Oh, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong spot. Any further testimony?
Yeah, usually.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Phil Stahlberger with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I also want to commend Representative Abler for having opened our policy and working on many of these issues. Page 9, Article 2, Section 5, we would still have a concern with the medication therapy management mandate. MAP for service is scheduled to include this in their coverage beginning this year. I think there were some initial thoughts that there would be some cost savings. We don't know if that is indeed going to happen or not. We prefer that before we put something in statute to make us pay for something we don't know is actually going to work, that we let it work in MAP for service first. So with that, I stand for any questions.
Okay. Questions from members? Brings up a question on Mr. Pender. Always got to be ready. Question for you on the medical therapy management. That is a mandate. So do we still have the mandate review process in place in statute?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. I'm not sure what its details are. I don't think it, if I remember right, it doesn't require that every mandate proposal be reviewed, but it allows for that to be done on request, I think. I haven't looked at it recently.
Okay.
But there is something.
Okay. I remembered we passed that a couple of years ago, so.
Do I sense a request coming, Mr. Chair?
Pardon?
Do I sense an amendment for request when I get back here?
Who knows? Representative, let's see. Goodwin, you have a question at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Representative Abler, I have a question. I know you started out in your committee and worked the last 2 years trying to find ways to contain health care costs, but I don't, as I go through this and look, I don't really see any way that the bill will control or contain health care costs, except by the one thing that concerns me the most is the increase in the co-pays and deductibles allowed. So how do you see this as containing health care costs?
Representative,
any of these provisions in here, except by people probably not getting medical care because they have too high of a deductible or too high of a copay.
Mr. Chair, it's important to look at health costs as a whole spectrum of costs. It's not simply what an employer pays, what an employee pays. It's important to remember that when Hennepin County Hospital treats a person as an uncompensated patient, that cost is borne by the property taxpayers, many of whom are elderly, in Hennepin County. It's important to remember that when you pay for a Minnesota Care person, that money's come out of the sick people's payments at the rate of 2%. So people who are sicker pay more to help people who need care. It's important to remember that when we subsidize some of these other community clinics out of the to help them be able to afford the state paid prices, if that comes as a grant from your income tax and sales tax. And on top of that, then you add what the employee pays in terms of deductibles and co-pays, and what the employer pays in terms of the premium. And then you have bad debt by the clinics, and that goes on. So there's a lot of costs. And we can only influence a little bit of that. We only influence 22% of the market by what this table can do. The uninsured, the ERISA groups, the self-insureds can do whatever they want. And so we can't tell them to put information on a card describing that they're a self-insured plan. We can't require them to do anything. And so that's the challenge that we have as a legislature. How do we go about it? And what this is here is trying to draw more people in to the group coverages to help employers continue to find ways to offer it, to help people who are individually covered to find ways they could afford to get coverage. My 23-year-old son is on his own. He got an individual plan, costs him about $90 a month. It's got a $2,000 deductible. It's a pretty good plan for a kid who's 23 who's going to live forever. At least he's got coverage, and so he could afford. We could help him afford the $2,000. That's a challenge before us, members. And so, is this going to make a direct impact? There's no feature in this bill to make a direct change, but many things added together will make a difference. Look at the parts in the healthcare part of my bill, which has already been to that committee. There is no silver bullet, but to require, this is the best that can be done with what we have to work with today, and to allow people that can't get covered somewhere else to pool together, to allow them to find ways to at least get the normal prices that 3M pays. It's still expensive. We still like healthcare, Mr. Chair and members. We still want to go to the doctor, get treated today, have a scan tomorrow, and find out that we're well the day after tomorrow, or that we have a problem. We like that. In Britain, if you're 75 years old and a bad hip, they give you a cane if you're lucky. We get a new hip if you're 85 and can live through surgery. I think that's a value, but it costs money. And so that's a cultural choice we make, which I endorse. You have a person with hemophilia that they cost $500,000 a year. We choose to let them live. I vote for that. But that all costs money, and that's where the costs are going, Mr. Chair. How we resolve that, I think, is to find a way to make it as affordable as we can for all. So I hope that's helpful to you. Okay.
We have Representative Mullery, and then we need to move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question. I'm trying to find it. I'd heard in here there was a provision that would belong in this committee about medical malpractice and inadmissibility of evidence and statements of fault. And is that in this bill, or is it in some other bill? And
yeah, that's
it's
going
got to come to this committee, I would assume.
No, that's going to civil law. I don't think it comes to this committee. I can bring it by amendment if you want. I'll tell you what I'm working on, just in very short. It simply says that if a doctor says he's sorry, not that he's at fault, but the part where he shows emotion and consideration, compassion, some feeling for his act, that, I mean, the person now is going to die, or there something bad happened that was unforeseen, if they are continuing to be the doctor and the doctor-patient relationship and expresses any kind of sympathy, that sympathy part can't be brought as part of the evidence. They're allowed to. And that's what that's about. If they say, I'm sorry I cut off your leg, the I cut off your leg part, that's admissible, but the I'm sorry part, that's all it is. It's a very tiny little niche. So the effort being to try to preserve the doctor-patient
relationship. I think what I was told was that it also covered fault, which would mean that I didn't read the chart, your name, and I cut off your right leg instead of sewing your left finger.
Yeah.
But, okay, I have no problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
I appreciate all your good dialogue, and if you want to talk to me in the weekend, I'm open. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Bradley. Chair will House File 3360 be recommended to pass and re-refer to Health Finance. It's going back your way?
Right. Okay. Because there is a fiscal law with it.
Representative Bradley, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know there's been good discussion. Some of it might even relate to this. Jim is absolutely right in what he said. There are no silver bullets, certainly no silver bullet in singular. And we need to come at the health care cost crises from every angle we can. This bill, and there's some sections that are relevant to commerce, others that would not be, I'll be happy to at least indicate those to you as well. But I will go through then House File 3658. The first four sections, and it looks like complicated language in the bill, but members, just to tell you what functionally it does, It would allow Minnesota to join the 49 other states that allow competition in the healthcare market by enabling for-profit HMOs to operate in Minnesota. That would be sections 1 through 4. Actually, sections 5...
Representative Bradley? I moved 3360.
Oh, I'm sorry. You did the other one first? You want me to do that one first?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
And, on the order, on the agenda that I saw, I was following that. I apologize. All right, let's do 3360. Then, Mr. Chair, on 3360, if you don't mind, I'd like you to move the DE3 amendment to get it in the shape that would be reviewed.
Yes, sir, move the DE3 amendment, and that's just to get it in the shape that Representative Bradley wishes to discuss. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Bradley, to the DE3 amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, the preface that I gave is relevant to this as well, and that is no silver bullets, but let's go at it every angle. If there's one area, and Representative Abler is absolutely right, one area where we have the greatest vulnerability to lose people being insured, it's in the small insurance marketplace. And although there are certainly other things that we need to do, one of the unique characteristics in that marketplace is that that marketplace pays for a high-risk pool, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Right now, it's in the range of about $100 million a year. That is, in my own personal opinion, and I think in many respects we've been very bipartisan in this opinion, that's an unfair tax. It's being placed on a vulnerable part of the marketplace. It is, in my opinion, and I think, again, we share this on a bipartisan level, the high-risk pool is a good idea. We have the largest one in the nation. It does help protect persons who would otherwise be uninsurable. But that really is a broad-based responsibility. It ought not to be placed simply on the people who work for small businesses. So, the first bill, I wish I could have brought this to you. I wish I could have figured out the numbers, because the original intent that I have was to try to figure out a way that we could completely eliminate the $100 million a year of assessment that is placed on insurance policies that are in turn applied in the small business area. There is not enough money in the source that I'm using. That's the Healthcare Access Fund. So I redrafted it. I promised Representative Huntley that I would draft it in a way that would be absolutely no harm to the Minnesota Care Program, would not invoke any of the Minnesota Care eligibility language that's in statute, and this is what this does. It would allocate $55 million a year in the next 3 years. We would end up with a small balance of surplus still in the current Minnesota Care Program based on current law. I think there's a good relationship. This is about helping people being covered. I think it's a reasonable use of the Healthcare Access Fund that does help people retain insurance. Without this supplement, of course, the people who are on that high-risk pool would pay a rate that would probably chase many of them off. So the only way, that we keep that high-risk pool affordable is by having this supplement. So, Mr. Chair, that's what the bill does. It's a pretty straightforward allocation of $55 million a year to help reduce the burden to small businesses and employers of small businesses.
Okay, let's take public testimony at this time, and I'd ask anyone who would like to speak to the bill to make sure they're speaking to the DE3 amendments. The rest of it's off the table, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about stuff that's off the table. So, Lynn Gruber, please.
Good afternoon, committee members. Mr. Chairman, my name is Lynn Gruber, President of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. I want to thank Representative Bradley for bringing this important issue to the table. We've talked about it for many years. The fact that the risk pool has a funding formula that was created in 1976, and the marketplace has changed remarkably in the area of self-insurance. So this amendment to the original bill is a great step in the right direction for finding a broader funding source for the MCHA. So we heartily approve of it. Thank you.
Okay. Any brief questions for Ms. Gruber? Representative Goodwin?
Thank you. And I asked you this question in health, but everybody wasn't there. That's here today. Some of the reason that you're saying that you want to move this money out of healthcare access funding into MSHA. Instead of the insurers who currently don't insure these people and therefore are paying a tax into MSHA, an assessment, is because when it changed, self-insurers didn't have to pay into this anymore after ERISA came into effect, that it wasn't fair really for these insurance companies that are left to have to pay this assessment. However, you also said in that testimony, I just want everybody to know that there are probably only about 200 out of 300,000 people that are on MCHA that are that are from self-insured plans or were formerly in self-insured plans or were rejected by their self-insured plan or for whatever reason. Is that correct?
Ms. Gruber.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin, I did say that we think approximately 200 out of 30,000 members are may have come from self-insured plans where they've maxed out on their lifetime max, something like that.
Okay. So then the real issue is what we would be doing would be taking money out of the healthcare access fund, making providers pay for the high-risk people who the insurance industry has turned down for healthcare. And so now instead of the insurers, and I understand people are going to say that that money is passed down to small businesses or whatever, but that now the providers and HMO, the amount that HMO pay, they're going to be paying the entire amount for people that are uninsured, or half of it, because about half of it is provided by premiums and half by assessment. So now we're going to be taking money out for people that also need health care and aren't getting it. And the thing I'm trying to figure out is, okay, if you only have a $10,000 hospital amount under Minnesota Care currently, so once you reach that, you could end up in MCHA or a public health program or something like that, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, MCHA's premiums, remember, are above market, so, you know, if somebody can afford MCHA's premiums, which are right now around 18% above market, they could come into MCHA, but Minnesota Care is based on ability to pay, so, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
Much right. Okay, so then the money that's been collected and appropriated for Minnesota Care then is now going to go to catastrophic care, pre-existing condition care for people that the insurance industry won't accept because of their condition. Correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin, first of all, I don't agree that providers pay this. Providers can pass this through. The law clearly states providers should be passing through the provider tax, and that's what we like about the Healthcare Access Fund. Because it is a broad-based tax where everybody basically that's purchasing some kind of health care benefit will be paying that, we believe that it is a very, very broad tax, which is exactly what you need to support a statewide organization like MCHA. You know, more of our members come from outstate than in the metro area, so all 87 counties we have members in all 87 counties. So I think you have to remember that the insurance companies are still paying the assessment. And it's what Representative Bradley's bill does is soften the blow a little bit to the real payers of the assessment that are small business people and individuals that are buying an insured product. That's really the crux of this thing, because so many companies and the state of Minnesota have gone self-insured. We are not able to assess them, so we're trying to find a way that is a broad-based way that gets the self-insureds involved again with helping support a statewide a benefit, if you will, MCHA, and that we think is accomplished through the Healthcare Access Fund.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So then,
Representative
Goodwin. And then the insurance companies who don't like to insure anybody unless they're guaranteed not to die or ever get sick are being allowed to get off the hook of sharing their risks across the and getting off the hook as far as giving people health insurance that are. Already have a pre-existing condition or can't get, or, you know, something else is wrong with them. So then we're saying, okay, insurance companies, you know, you basically don't have to pay much or hardly anything, and even less under this bill, if anything. And yet, you know, you're getting off the hook, but everybody else is going to pay for
the people that you refuse to basically cover.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I respectfully disagree with you. In fact, there are more companies that sell group insurance that pay our assessment than sell individual insurance. So way back when, in 1976, when the legislature created MCHA, the idea was everybody that's going to sell some kind of a health product in Minnesota is going to contribute to the support of MCHA. And through time, as you know, it's been chipped away by ERISA. So I don't agree that insurance companies are getting away. I think the idea is to spread the risk fairly across as broad a base as you can to support something that's good for Minnesota. I guess that's the way I look at it.
To that point, Representative Gazalta.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And maybe Representative Bradley could give us the numbers of how many people are covered under large employer self-insured plans, because those are all the people right now that are not paying into this at all. Roughly what percentage of the market that is?
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gazalka, best I recall, I think of the insured marketplace, about 70% of the marketplace is self-insured.
So, Mr. Chair, the way it is right now, we have 70% of the people that have benefits that are not paying to help these other people that basically can't get health insurance. And I love the proposal because we're spreading it out among everybody that has insurance, and everybody is participating in this.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I hope that we recognize the economics of health insurance and who pays. I can tell you who I want off the hook are my constituents who work in these small companies. Because any way you cut it, the ultimate payer of these assessments for MCHA are the people who work in those small companies. I mean, that's just the reality. And you could argue about the insurance companies, but the insurance companies are in the business of paying bills, a certain amount of margins, and that's it. And this extra $100 million a year, in fact, is really paid by yours and my constituents who are in the small companies. And let's give them a break.
Yeah. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2 points. One, I think just a point. I guess if I could convince the health care providers in my district that they're not paying MCHA, I think I'd get a lot of them off my back. So maybe I'll pass that information on to them. The question I have, I think, mostly for Representative Bradley, in my district too, as I talk to small employers, their number one concern that I hear is they can't afford insurance. There's so many of their employees, they don't have it. Sometimes there's actually a handful of employers that I've talked to, because of their commitment to their employees, they offer their employees insurance, but they don't have insurance for themselves and their family. And so I guess what I would like to hear is how can we be assured that in fact this is going to decrease the cost to the small employers? I mean, I think I share that goal with you. How do we know that's actually going to be the outcome of this?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look at the language, the first paragraph, I believe, of the language, which actually comes out of current law, requires, with the supervision of the Department of Commerce and Health, that any of these savings be passed through.
Representative Moe, answer it. Is it to that point?
Yes, that point.
Representative Goodwin.
But the issue is that, yes, the department can guarantee that the 2% reduction takes place, but they can't stop any other. They can't, you know, the insurance industry can still make it up and still continue to charge. As the cost of health care, the biggest increases have been in the insurance company rates, over and above the medical costs. So if the insurance industry loses money on investments like they've been doing lately, they can make it up in the cost of their policies and their premium costs. So we have really no guarantee that this 2% that does get passed down from the MCHA break is going to then result in lower premium costs overall, that it's going to stop the inflationary rate of insurance, health insurance in general. So,
Mr. Gross?
Or that, and I think, Mr. Chair and Representative Moore, your point was well made. The big problem with small employers is that they just can't afford health insurance at all. And I believe this would, one person testified in health, that this would mean about $60 less a year in the cost to a small employer for their health care. So if they can't afford insurance at all, just $60 less is hardly going to make them be able to suddenly start affording health care. So,
Mr. Gross, can health insurers raise their rates on policies willy-nilly and just make up for it and bury it in the numbers? Is the Department of Commerce letting that go through?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm with the Department of Commerce. The Commerce Department, basically, for individual health products, the company has to send us their proposed rate increase. We have to prove it. We have an actuarial staff that looks at it very, very, very closely. In fact, we are hired by the health department to also look at their proposed rate increases and make a recommendation back to them. I can assure everybody in this room that a lot of companies, what they want, they don't get. In fact, we got sued 2 years ago by a company that wanted what we call a high rate increase. They took us to court. They lost. We also have a bad reputation because we're kind of hard-nosed about companies that actually can demonstrate a need for a rate increase. But we like companies to look at rates every year and see if they need to change their rates. And this one company came in with a what we considered a high rate increase. So we said, no, we're not going to accept this. We asked them to come back with something that was more reasonable. For example, let's say the company wants to raise the rates 20%. We'll say, well, we think that's unreasonable. If you come back with something reasonable, let's say 15%, 10%, we'll accept that. But we want to make sure that the companies remain solvent, but at the same time, we think that the company should be looking at it on a yearly basis, what they're doing, and trying to do rate increases on an incremental basis. But if we think that the policyholders are going to suffer, we are not going to approve it.
Mr. Gross, what are the minimum loss ratios in this state, and where is the market currently as far as loss ratios?
Mr. Chairman, members, I can't remember offhand what all the loss ratios are, but in most cases, especially for the large carriers, they're above the loss ratio, so the consumer is getting a bargain.
They're above the minimums that are set by law?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That point, Representative.
Just to Representative Goodwin's and my original question, then, just for my knowledge, because this is not my particular field, if this bill were to pass, then, and you were and $55 million from the MSHA were to go into this pool, how technically would you do that to reduce the rates for the small employers? How would that happen?
What we've done this, Mr. Chairman and Representative Moll, we've done this in the past. We look at every rate increase that comes in, and we make sure that that's addressed in the rate increase, that they're saying that, all right, now we don't have to pay this. This is going to be a benefit to the company, so they're going to be looking for that. And if it's not in there, we're going to go back and quiz them on it.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Gross. A couple of things. First, how many do insurance companies have to... on any increase, any amount of increase, do they have to get approval from your department, or is there a certain amount they can go up to and increase on their own without getting approval?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Griffin, any change, up or down, has to get our approval.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, along the same lines, Mr. Gross, how many rejections, how many did that last year? What was the percentage of rejections, the percentage you asked for increases?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Good, I would say for health insurance, about half were rejected.
Half of the increases were rejected, Mr. Chair. Half of the health care increases, the amount that they asked for, or it was, what do you do then? Do you say, you know, instead of 15%, you can raise a 13%. What do you do,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodman? We don't make that suggestion, because if we came back with a suggestion, then the company would say, well, the Commerce Department has made us increase your rates this percentage. So we're saying to them, you come back with something that's reasonable.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and then Mr. Gross. So when they do that, is this kind of a normal thing that insurance companies put in more than they want the first time, then they can come back with a little less, and then they can get you to accept that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Good, no, because we look at what they're proposing, and you know, they have to show us their actual losses, their et cetera, et cetera. Every company has to be examined every 3 years, financial solvency. When the examiners go out, they look at all the data that they have in their annual statement. We can go look at their annual statement and figure out what's going on. So they can't, in a sense, fudge or fake the numbers.
Okay, Mr. Chair, a couple more questions, as long as I've got your ear and I'm learning here. So thank you for answering my questions. What is the chance that insurance companies won't you know, I guess I can only ask you like averages and medians, but what are the average increases that have been granted over the last, let's say, 10 years or 5 years or whatever you have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't answer that. That Senator actually is not here. But I would say that, you know, it depends again on the product. It depends on, for some companies, let's put it this way, they wind up getting hurt because they project that X amount of people are going to have claims, what the dollar amount is, and unfortunately they get stuck with the bad guys a lot more than anticipated. So their rates are a lot higher. And we have to consider those type of situations where the other thing we really try to insist on that companies do is adequately reserve. When they get the premium day one, remember a policy in the beginning is usually not going to have much losses to it because the company has the right to underwrite. So we want to make sure that they properly reserve over starting from day one to make sure they got enough dollars down the road. Take care of for those proposed or needed rate changes.
Right, so Mr. Chair, if they don't have enough reserves, then you would, I
suppose. To Representative Rukavina, then Representative Liebling, then take public testimony.
And I would assume then if you don't have, if they don't have enough reserves, then you would allow a larger rate increase in order to maintain it. And the second question I have off my mind right now, so just the last question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Woodland, the reserves are for that particular product, that particular form. The company overall has to have a horrendous amount of reserves just for everything else, and that's something we look at very, very closely to make sure that they're adequately reserved for the ups and downs on the, like in this too.
And Mr. Chair, do they get to use their rates before they get to use their rates once they file them, and then you decide whether you approve them or disapprove them, or do they have to wait to raise their rates until after you give your okay?
Mr. Chairman, they have to wait until we approve of it. They can't go out and do that. Representative Gavina.
Well, I had a question before I get into my question. Mr. Gross, I'm glad to hear that Department of Commerce is enforcing laws and taking on insurance companies because one of my constituents that helped me that does the HMOs for windshields, I call them, you know, that windshield law that we passed where they couldn't steer. They've been steering up in northern Minnesota. We also said they couldn't charge the geographic area that's...
Can we keep it to the bill? Because we're going to be here. We're going to be late into the night.
But the
right
Department of Commerce told them we can't. We don't have enough people to enforce that law. And I want to get...
That's not the bill, though, Representative Rufino.
Well,
let's stick to
here's
it.
Here's my question on the bill.
Thank you.
First of all, Representative Bradley, you know, if you want to help your constituents who aren't businesses, your constituents are people, why don't you let small business people join in to Minnesota Care?
Representative Bradley.
Taking $55 million out because, Mr. Gross, I don't know who you're stopping from raising rates, which insurance companies, but every small business person I have that's trying to provide business health insurance to their employees is telling me their insurance is jumping 15, 18, 19% a year.
Kind of like the state budget for health care, isn't it?
To
that point.
So I don't know how we're stopping these insurance companies from raising rates when all these small businesses are saying this. So, Representative, why don't you just let them join Minnesota Care and we can use this money to help your constituents?
Representative Bradley.
Sure, Representative Rukavina. You could have been there. I think we spent about an hour and a half debating that in our Health Policy and Finance Committee. I believe it was mentioned earlier. I don't think you'd want your constituents making at least a decent amount of money who would not be wanting to spend on, not wanting to put all of their assets on the line. One, the range of full payment for Minnesota Care. Remember now, Minnesota Care is a package. The people paying premiums only pay about 10% of the expense of Minnesota Care. The plan that you're talking about was to put people on at a full charge for Minnesota Care. The premium rate was in the $800 to $1,100 per month rate for, I think, a family of four or whatever it was. That's not a particularly good deal, number one. Number two, a $10,000 cap on their hospital benefit puts all of their assets on the line. It may sound intriguing, but I mean, we spent a lot of time on that. It just turned out, for yours and my constituents, the idea of putting people on Minnesota Care in that kind of situation is not. If you could find better alternatives. You know, Minnesota Care doesn't turn out to be an affordable option or a good insurance option at all for those people.
Representative Vandiver had something at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Rucavina is right, because we want to be consistent. And if it's not working, we need to put more people in it.
Well, I have people in Minnesota Care that are very appreciative of having it. And I have others that maybe. I had a lady yesterday, Mr. Chair, members in my office, and they were down with the family handicapped, and they had one of their clients down. They work in a Lutheran social service home. I think they went to see Representative Curtis after me, and the lady's a single mother, and she works two jobs, and she makes just a few hundred bucks more than the limit for Minnesota Care, but she would love to have some to meet on Minnesota Care, and she asked me what she should do. I said, quit one job. You know, just go. That's the best way to do it. We don't want, obviously, we don't reward people for work around here. But, Mr. Chair, I do want to ask President Bradley, is the contributing member in your delete all amendments, is the contributing member an insurance company, or is it a business? On line 14.
Ms. Gruber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, contributing member is always referred to the businesses that are a part of the association pay the assessment, the company's insurers.
So,
Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't call anybody on this committee that was around when we gave that $1 billion back, maybe that you two were, to WICRA. And we wrote the law so tight that all of our small Main Street businesses were going to get this money back from the insurance industry. We wrote this tight law. We ran it. Every lawyer around here looked at it, probably Mr. Fender and everybody else. And boy, whoa, this is going to be great. $1 billion. The insurance company took us to court. They won. They never passed a penny on to any Main Street business. And the only ones that got it were the self-insured. So my question is, if it's a contributing member, is an insurance company that pays for the Main Street business, how are you guaranteeing that this is going back to the Main Street business and not to Mr. Johnson's good client?
Ms. Gruber?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, I don't have the bill in front of me, but I think we're still going to the portion of the bill that talks about Commerce Department having to assure that when they do the rate filings, they have taken that amount out of their increased premium.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cooper, you were wrong here when we did that WICRA rebate. We wrote the law that said it was going to go back to the people that paid the insurance companies, them small Main Street businesses. And Mr. Johnson's clients took us to court, and not a penny got back to the Main Street businesses. His clients got all of our money. Where does this guarantee that his clients aren't going to get all the money again?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, that is up to the Department of Commerce to assure.
My HMO windshield people.
That was what the last half hour testimony was about with Mr. Gross, Representative Rucavina.
Yeah, I could bet you guys didn't want to lay any bets that we're going to beat the insurance.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a comment and then a couple quick questions for Representative Bradley. Representative Bradley, I certainly share your goal of reducing the cost for small employers. I think we all do here. I don't think there's any question that small employers are struggling. A lot of them can't afford insurance that they really want to have. And I had a meeting with a lot of them in my district, and I heard from a lot of people that they're at a competitive disadvantage with larger companies and because they can't get employees that they want who will start with them and then leave as soon as they can get a job with health insurance and so on and so on. So it's a terrible problem. We all agree on that. And I applaud your idea of having it be a more broad-based assessment. But the real question for me is, does this make it more broad-based? I have real concerns about putting more expenses on the health care access fund that are these kind of expenses and just shifting from one pocket of one small pocket to another small pocket. So I just want to ask you if you have numbers on how many entities are paying AMCHA's assessment now and how many are paying the provider tax now. Because when you talk about it being more broad-based, I want to understand how much more broad-based this would be. Because frankly, I'd like to see it really broad-based, because I think that having everybody have health insurance is a societal benefit to all of us, because any of us could then be in that position at any time.
And I frankly would like to see it on the spread even as a general fund item.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, well, first of all, we just don't have the resources in terms of the general fund. This happens to be an opportunity where we're keeping the Minnesota Care, not raising the percentage of provider tax. I don't think there's any question about the fact that if only 30% of the insured, and that doesn't include all the public assistance programs, it doesn't include even our state employees, we don't pay the MCHA assessments, as a matter of fact, so it's a very narrow part of the market, as opposed to every healthcare transaction that's paying the provider tax. Now, I'm not a big fan of the provider tax. I don't think there's anybody around here who's worked harder to get rid of the provider tax than I have. The reality is there's an organization called the Senate across the street that stopped this every time. So long as there is a surplus and we're covering the Minnesota Care, it seems to me that this is a reasonable use for that. You might also recall members of the committee, and I think Representative Liebling, you were among those who voted against the proposal that I had that would have used a 30-cent cigarette tax to have offset all of the MCHA assessment.
Representative Liebling and members, if you look in your, I think it was distributed after the packet, but the chart that shows all the health care taxes, the bottom one that covers every employer is the provider tax, which would probably be called the health sales tax, because it's passed on by the providers. They're the only ones that think that they'll get any benefit if we repeal it. The MCHA, on the other hand, is only paid for by a small, the narrow group that comprises about a third of the market. So it does, Representative Bradley's proposal does take it from the narrow base to the broadest base that we have. Representative Liebling.
To that point, Mr. Chair, well, Representative Bradley, I don't think you really answered my question here. I mean, I understand, Representative Wilkin, what you're saying, but when we look at this graph, all these three bars are the same width. They're not proportional to how many people are in these various categories, and that's really what I'm asking. Sure. How many people are in these various categories?
Because it's trying to show the three different categories of employer that what burden they bear. It doesn't show how broad those categories are, but the two over here are the two that are bearing the biggest burden are about a third of the market. As far as those who were bearing the burden of the MCHA assessment that Representative Bradley's trying to lessen.
Right.
And it's not a perfect chart for that, obviously, but that is the number.
Right. Representative Wilkin, this is answering a different question than the one I'm asking, because I understand that only a third of those who are covered by, who have health insurance policy, so to speak, of all types are paying this assessment. But what I'm asking is, how does it compare, the numbers who are paying that assessment, how does that compare to those who are paying the provider tax?
That's what I'm trying to say, and, okay. And I'm probably not saying it in a very clear way, but okay. these two categories that are the taller graphs are one-third of the market. The other one is two-thirds of the market. And so the provider tax catches all of those. The provider tax catches the people who are in the self-insureds.
Okay.
And that's the point. That's about the only way we can get the self-insureds because ERISA.
Right. I understand.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have exact numbers, but I think you can sort of put it in this rough context. Maybe there's $5 million Minnesotans who are all one way or another paying the provider tax if they have any health care transactions. That's pretty broad. I'm not saying it's fair, but that's what it is. On the other hand, with the fractionalization of the remainder of the marketplace, there would be certainly less, I would guess, somewhere between 500,000 and a million people in Minnesota who would be paying the MCHA assessment.
Okay, Representative Loffa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bradley, we've talked a lot about the impact on the market and insurance. I just want to understand a little bit more about what the impact is on the healthcare access fund and the individuals served by that. I know there's a significant surplus right now, and I know we need to solve this problem for MCHA, but I think I've heard that surplus is really sort of a transitory thing, that the projections going forward wouldn't provide for this sort of transfer, is that correct, into out years? And I think we ought to have a heads up if we approve this, if there's going to be a problem, you know, 3-4 years down the line that we're going to have to look at revamping Minnesota Care or once again finding another pool of money for MCHA.
Representative
Mr. Chair, I'm very sensitive to that, and that's exactly why the proposal changed the way it did. The end of the 3 years, it would be about a $20 million balance using this formula. And if you look at the language of the bill, beyond that, we only use to the extent that there is excesses available, period. So we're only set at the $55 million for 3 years, and at the end of the 3 years, based on current forecast, we would still have $20 million extra in the health care access fund.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bradley, does that mean then that we would not hit a point at which we would have to disenroll people or freeze enrollment based on the way your bill is written?
Representative Bradley.
Representative Loeffler, absolutely. And I'm very sensitive to that, yes.
Representative Rukavina.
Sure, I'm still not satisfied with the answer I got from you, because I didn't ask you the question. Where's Mr. Gross? Can I ask him a question again?
If I didn't answer it, how could you be not satisfied?
You told me you have an answer. I never got an answer. I want to go back to the fact that we wrote this really tough law about WICRA to do the same thing that Representative Bradley's trying to do, and the money never got to the small businesses that the insurance companies. So Mr. Gross, explain it to this very simpleton representative here that you're looking at, that how you're going to guarantee that $55 million in premium charges go back to a Main Street business.
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, when we look at the rate increases for any company, for individuals, large employer, small employer, whatever, we're going to try to address the fact that the company that has to pay the MCHA assessments is now getting a break with up to $255 million. I don't know how much that's going to equate out to, but we're going to look at to make sure that the company addresses that in their actual memorandum, that they're taking in consideration the fact that their amount of money they have to pay in this assessment back to MCHA has been decreased by this amount of money that MCHA is now going to receive.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
When you were answering Representative Goodwin's questions about so many companies come a year and ask for it and you refuse half of them to ask for an increase, for those that don't ask for anything and don't approach you, they don't come before your department, how are you going to get tell them that they have to give back this assessment to their members or to their
Mr. Gross, when was the last time a health carrier didn't have an increase in any given year?
Mr. Chairman, I can assure you that all the small employer health plans have a rate increase on an annual basis. You might have a few companies that in the individual market won't have a rate increase, but that means then the rates are staying static. They're not going up.
So, Mr. Chair, what Representative Bradley is doing is helping his Main Street businesses with a little less of an increase. That's what he's doing.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, then.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Johnson's clients still win.
I don't think that's what I heard. Representative Clark?
I heard.
Well, I just want to thank Representative Rukavina for being the historian that he is in many of these issues, because I think we keep making the same mistakes if we don't know, you know, what we've done in the past. So I appreciate your raising that issue, and I don't think you really did totally get an answer either. But I think the claim that this is going to be a break for small businesses, now this last testimony makes clear that not necessarily. They may not have as big an increase, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to have any real help with their high rates. I just want to ask a separate question, though, which is, I think, Representative Bradley, what you're talking about in answer to Representative Loeffler's question depends on Minnesota Care not in any way changing any of its entitlements or any of its ways of providing services. Isn't that right? I mean, you're not projecting that we would decide as a group that there ought to be better coverage, there ought to be more people coming under part of the sliding fee scale. Is that right? I mean, you're basing it on no improvement to Minnesota Care. Is that right? Is no improvement from a consumer standpoint.
Senator Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, Minnesota would continue to spend more per capita on public assisted health care than virtually any other state in the nation, but as I indicated before, it is based on current law.
I just think, Mr. Chairman, I think that's important because we can't guarantee the answer to Representative Lapa's question unless we say that we're not ever going to improve, you know, the services under Minnesota Care. That's what that's based on. And I just think that should be on the table because should there be, you know, this administration or another one that says, you know, we think we ought to cover more families. We think we ought to extend the eligibility, use some of that money that's in the excess fund that we haven't used. Then we're in trouble with these folks. So I just want to make sure I understood that. And I think if that's what we're voting on, what, you know, when we look at this.
Yeah, one clarification.
Briefly.
It's only 3 years. After that, the language is the general language, and if the legislature decided, obviously the legislature can change language any time. You understand that, everybody. But after the third year, it's only to the limit that there's any excess. So if there were changes, then the amount that would be available in the excess would diminish.
Okay, this would be a good time to hear from small business. So, Ms. Sexton, would you please join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Erin Sexton with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I think you've had a very thorough discussion on this, so I'll be very brief. We are very supportive of House File 3360. This, as you've all heard, this assessment falls very unfairly on small and large businesses, those businesses that are least able to afford these growing costs. These small and medium businesses need this relief, and anything that we can provide those small businesses will be helpful, no matter what that amount is. So I encourage your support of this legislation.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sexton, if the assessment gets too high, what will happen to small employers? What will their reaction be?
Well, I think what we're already starting to see and some information from the Department of Health is group coverage is continuing to decline. In 2001, about 68% of our population was covered by group policy, and now it's 61. So I think we're seeing that the stress at the growing costs of health care is that small and medium businesses are just not able to provide this coverage to their employees. So I think any relief that we can provide will help them continue to provide good benefits to their employees.
Thank you. I totally agree with her assessment. One time, our group health insurance policy at the store I used to own were equal to our net profits.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this burden is getting to be extremely high in many small businesses, and anything we can do to alleviate that, I think we should consider.
Representative Goodwin.
Yes. You, Ms. Sexton, you represent the insurance industry, too, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, yes, they are a portion of our membership, but this legislation requires that the savings are passed on to businesses, and I think that we would be very upset if that did not happen. So,
and Mr. Chair and Ms. Sexton, I just want to also ask you if you think that a small employer would stop offering health insurance if his premiums suddenly went down $60 a year for his health care, or didn't go down $60 a year for the health care assessment, but his insurance rate still went up to provide health care for his employees, as they've been doing every year. I have a lot of sympathy for small employers trying to provide health care, and that's not the issue. The issue here is, are they really going to be able to either afford it easier with the cost of, because it's only $60 less a year? Or are they going to be able to still going to be dropping out? I mean, next year, can you come back and say more small employers have health insurance now, or less small employers are dropping their health care because of this? Are you going to ever be able to say that because of this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I think Representative Bradley was very clear. This isn't a silver bullet, but we're looking for anything that will help, and this is one thing that will pass on a tangible, direct premium savings to those employers who are paying that assessment right now, which is a very small portion of the employers in the state. It's a small, medium, a large portion of employers, but it's the small and medium employers in the state who are paying it. This isn't the end-all, be-all, but this will help, and that's what we're looking for is things that will help.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and members,
just reacting to Representative Rukavina's concern about and Representative Goodwin's about whether or not this will actually come through to the small employers and help them with their issue. I'm not sure of all the implications, but one route we could take would be to take the $55 million, and I don't think we say thank you enough to the employers who are hanging in there in a tough market and are providing health insurance to their employees, and it might be kind of intriguing to look at a model in which we'd take these dollars and send them with as a thank you acknowledgement from the state, and had it directly, we'd save certainly Mr. Gross a lot of and his staff a lot of work trying to calculate whether or not this, you know, 1.87% or whatever percent, 1.97% actually did get translated through, and all the increased costs and the decreased, you know, rate setting is not easy, and we could probably do this more elegantly and in a direct connection to those small businesses rather than working it through a change in the healthcare access fund, a change in MTA funding that we know is probably a short-term solution, and it might be, I would like Ms. Sexton's reaction to, would employers rather get it direct rather than through this convoluted system?
And then would it be passed on to their employees? Because if it isn't, if the premiums go down, it is. But if it's just a check to the employer, there's no guarantee, right?
Mr. Chair, that is probably true, but I don't know that this is as convoluted as you think. I mean, the hope is, I think the wording is very clear. I think the insurers, I have a feeling you, as the Commerce Committee and the legislature, would hold those insurance companies accountable if they don't pass this on. So we think this is a pretty clear way to pass it on, but if you have other ideas that will help small employers, we would be love to hear them and happy to work with you on those.
Okay, there were some other people who wanted to testify. Mr. Schwartz, you got 2 minutes. The bill significantly scaled down from when we heard you two nights ago.
My name is John Schwartz. I'm director of United Health System, A. Nonprofit health system research organization. All I'm going to do is address some of the statistical issues that have just been mentioned here, because there's been a great deal of misstatement. The comment was made by Representative Bradley that self-insurance in Minnesota represents 70% of Minnesotans, insured Minnesotans. That is false. The number is 40%. And the source of that is the Minnesota Department of Health, Health Economics Program, which is something called a chart book every year. The data I'm referring to is from the year 2003. I believe it comes from Section 3. You can find that on our website. That number tracks with other reporting. So based on that means 2 million Minnesotans are covered by self-insured plans. As far as the number of people subject to the assessment of MSHA, only 40% of the total premium revenue that's included in MSHA assessment comes from the small employer and individual markets. 60% of the assessment is applied to other policyholders of Minnesota's health insurers. What that means is $40 million a year is derived from small employer individual markets, therefore falling on their shoulders. A higher amount, about 45%, falls on the shoulders of state programs. They are subject to...
Stop, please. You made that allegation the other night.
Not an allegation.
Yes, it is.
I can cite the data.
You have one source.
No.
Maybe the Department of Finance?
False. I removed my name. No. I'm sorry. Department of Commerce. June 2005. It's on their website. For an extremely long title. I'm sure Mr. Gross can cite that figure. The 5 billion total that I'm claiming I was going to bring this documentation in, but I removed my name from testifying to other issues. It comes from Redden and Anders, the actuary for MSHA. Department of Commerce. If you want to question the Department of Commerce, please ask Mr. Biss. If you want to question the Department of Health, call them. I believe Scott Wright is manager of a relevant area.
I'm familiar with
it. Good. Ask him for the data. It's there. If you want it, I can email it to you.
Please do.
Another certificate. These graphs are wrong. Which is the statute governing which establishes the assessment, does apply to HMOs. This middle graph here does not represent the MSHA assessment for applying to HMOs.
Okay, could you please wrap up your assessment?
Yes. The point about the assessment, it does not fall on rich and small employers and individuals. About $45 million falls on public programs. That is publicly financed money. This bill attempts to try to set up some public financing for the MSHA assessment. It already exists. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That should skinny down the fiscal note significantly. Mr. Harmon, would you like to specify? If you could keep it brief, we do have to get on.
My name is Mark Harmon, and I apologize for the hat, but I'm pretty light sensitive. A lot of rhetoric here today, a lot of discussion. It's extraordinarily important. I can give you stories that would take hours of folks that I know that live and reside in Ely and work their tails off and are extremely passionate and disgusted with insurance companies. But I won't get loquacious with that. But in the animal world, and I've got to do a joke here because you only get a few chances at this.
You've got 2 minutes and part of that's gone, so I'd skip the joke.
Mr. Chair, if I could. This gentleman is a citizen, and he came all the way from Ely, Minnesota, which is about as far as you can get away from his capital. I was in international call. And we let other lobbyists and that come here and talk and don't restrict them that live in this city. And I think that's absolutely outrageous.
Representative Rukavina, I'm just trying to keep the testimony on point. Thank you.
And you've taken me with all due respect.
Mr. Chair, if I could. You didn't respect the lady from the Chamber of Commerce, and she lives in this community.
I believe the testimony was on point.
Maybe it's the hat. I'm sorry.
No, you can leave your hat on.
I'm overheating now. The joke is, in the animal world, in the healthcare in the animal world, a white-tailed deer, a doe, comes out of the woods, totally disheveled and full of grass and dirt, and says, "I'll never do that for $2 again." Whoa. This is a tough crowd, okay. I am a recipient of Minnesota Care. Wintergreen Designs in Ely, Minnesota. Susan Trinke cannot pay her employees' health care. $10 an hour, $10.50 an hour. I don't know how many people you know that are trying to survive and are scared to death about their health care. And with all due respect, this is one of the most important things you people can discuss in this state. And for 2 minutes of your time, I'm close now. I will probably get back into politics again. I was on the Planning and Zoning Committee in Ely. I ran for mayor, dropped out. Egos get in the way. And insurance companies are actually full of egos because you have to clear things through them in order for the state to find out about how it's supposed to help its people. For the love of God, think about it. You got to think about this. Insurance companies are, what do you call them? There are no TV sitcoms about insurance companies. Mr. Rukavina, if anyone wants to speak to me, I have so much testimony, and I'd be happy to continue this at another time. But Tom knows me, and for what it's worth, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Harmon. That being said, I think we're ready to represent Bradley. I will renew my motion that House File 3360 be recommended to pass and referred to the Health Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Okay, Representative Fultz.
Mr. Chair, members, there was an announcement that went out this morning. The Bioscience Division is going to be meeting on Monday. I'm not sure who's going to be able to be around this afternoon or this evening, so I wanted to make sure that people are aware of that. 12:30, we have a Representative Mahoney bill that needs to move, and so we're going to get it out. We need to make sure that members are there so we have a quorum and we can act on the bill.
Okay, members, we're going to have to come back for the other bills. It's either going to be 400 North after session or 300 South at 5:30. So just plan on 400 North after session at this point, and we'll try to get these bills done. Thank you. We are in recess.